Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Rachel Smolkar. She's a co-director of Biofuel Watch and works with the Global Forest Coalition and the Campaign to Stop GE Trees. She's researched, written, and organized on the impacts of biofuels, bioenergy, and biochar on land use, forests, biodiversity, food, people, and the climate. She has a PhD in ecology/biology. She's the author of To Touch a Wild Dolphin. She lives in Vermont. So thank you so much for your work, and thank you for being on the program.
Thanks for having me.
Well, today what I'm going to talk about is geoengineering. So can you, let's presume that the readers are sympathetic, but they might not know much about it. So first, can you just say what it is and why it is and what's wrong with it?
Sure. Climate geoengineering refers to garbage bin, if you will, of technologies that are being promoted or considered for dealing with CO2 overload in the atmosphere, if you will, and either masking some of the symptoms of global warming or actually removing CO2 from the atmosphere. And there are a whole bunch of technologies that have been put in there, but it's kind of defined in terms of like the deliberate intervention with global atmospheric greenhouse gas and the global atmosphere. So it's a an attempt to, you know, people who have been working on this for a while will say that it's, you know, the idea is that that we could get our backs against the wall and have no other, you know, no other way out from dealing with the consequences of climate change. We might need some emergency measures, some technology that we can pull out of a hat and will, either buy time or help us to solve the problem. So the technologies that are included in that are things that would block entry of sunlight into the atmosphere. Solar radiation management, it's referred to a lot of the time. And that one of the main technologies there is to spew sulfate particulates into the stratosphere, where they would reflect sunlight back out into space. And that is somewhat analogous to what happens when we have a volcanic eruption. And we know from looking at the historical record on volcanoes that that does indeed have sort of chaotic effects of cooling and preventing sunlight from... It also has other effects like halting rainfall in different parts of the globe and so on and so forth. But so this would be not relying on volcanoes, but actually doing that ourselves, either delivering it by some kind of a hose or some kind of a aircraft or whatever. Now, some people believe this is already being done, but no. So that's one of the classes of technologies. The others are sometimes referred to as carbon dioxide removal. Those are things that would attempt to actually remove CO2 from the atmosphere, you know, on a very grand scale. And they include technologies like ocean iron fertilization, the idea being that plankton, the phytoplankton, are limited in their growth by the availability of iron. So if you dump a bunch of iron, you could stimulate blooms of phytoplankton, and the phytoplankton absorb carbon when they grow, and then they would die and sink to the bottom of the ocean and take all that carbon with them. And there's been a number of experiments with that, which people may be familiar with, the most recent one being in Haida. The other kinds of approaches that are being discussed, and one of the most prominent ones, is bioenergy with carbon capture and sequestration, also called BECCS. And that's gained a lot of momentum recently. The IPCC incorporated that into models, basically saying that it was essential to have some way to actually remove CO2 from the atmosphere, not just slow our flow of new CO2, but actually remove CO2 that's already there. And the only available technology they could put into their models currently that they thought might work would be BECCS. I got involved in this specifically because, having worked on looking at the impacts of large-scale industrial and commercial-scale bioenergy for a lot of years, and being aware of the impacts of, you know, huge new demands for wood and crops for biofuels and so on, this raised my alarms, because of course it would take massive, massive quantities of biomass material to, if you wanted to try and alter global CO2 by using that. The other problem with that, of course, is that it assumes that, it assumes that if you do, you know, some kind of a bioenergy process, say burning wood for electricity, that there's no CO2 emitted in that process. None. You know, it's carbon neutral is the term. The idea being that, you know, if you cut down a tree and burn it for electricity, a new tree will grow. The new tree will absorb the same amount of carbon back out of the atmosphere, which is very simplistic, you know, lacks a holistic perspective on the world.
I think the technical term for the scientific problem with that is the word crap.
Thank you. So, yeah, it's troubling, but that is the logic that has actually created a huge industry in bioenergy. And it's actually, you know, we see coal plants converting to burning wood for electricity. They get to get subsidized as producing renewable energy. They can account for it as zero emissions. And this is a huge emerging problem that we at Biofuel Watch have been working on and watching for some time. But the people in the climate geoengineering world say, oh, well, if it's carbon neutral, what if we just attach something to the smokestack and capture that carbon on the way out, and then we can bury it somewhere? So any new tree that would grow after the one that we burned would actually be absorbing new carbon. It wouldn't just be replacing the carbon from the tree that we burned. It would be absorbing new carbon out of the atmosphere. And if we do that on a huge, big, grand scale, we can, you know, somehow fix fix the global atmosphere that way. And it sounds nuts when you, you know, talk to people about it, but this is seriously on the table and is seriously being discussed as one of the near-term feasible means of doing this. So that's one of the major climate geoengineering technologies. There's others that have been discussed. Some people are familiar with biochar. Biochar was in there among technologies for climate geoengineering, although the recent National Academies report basically said, you know what, that's not going to work. We're not even going to consider that as a viable alternative. And then there are a lot of sort of more, you know, more nutty ideas out there, like what if we cut down lots of trees and bury them, dump them in, out in the deep ocean, and bury the carbon in those trees in the deep ocean, where it's far away from the atmosphere, and then the new trees that will grow. It's the same idea. New trees will grow and absorb new carbon out of the atmosphere. So those are some of the technologies that are out there. That's not an exhaustive list. People can look for the reports from the National Academies that just came out, two different reports, one on solar radiation management and one on carbon dioxide removal. The bottom line is there's a bunch of people who are sitting around trying to come up with schemes and plans that they think could potentially work to alter the global, you know, balance of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. But, you know, the other issue about it is like who are those people and what are their interests and what are the political ramifications? In addition to our concerns about the environment, we know, for example, from modeling studies that solar radiation management, you know, injecting sulfates into the stratosphere would have serious repercussions on rainfall in the global south, and particularly in the Sahara. It depends where you do your, where you, you know, spew the sulfate particles, where the impacts will be felt, but it's a global system that we live in, and, you know, tweaking one end of it on a massive scale with a deliberate intent of, you know, of, altering the global atmospheric balance is going to have unanticipated and unequally distributed results around the globe. So there's a lot of discussion about, okay, well, if that's the case, then how do we govern it? And, you know, who governs it? Who develops the technologies? Who has access to that? There's a lot of concern about the potential weaponization of particularly of solar radiation management. It's not expensive to do, spew sulfate particles into the stratosphere. So it's not expensive or even necessarily technically all that daunting. So there's a lot of concern that it's sort of easily available, but has huge consequences, and it could become sort of a tool that people use as a wielding as a weapon. The CIA was actually involved in funding these reports that just were released by the National Academy of Science. So there's an awareness of the potential weaponization. And of course, weather modification has been used in the context of military activities in the past, with cloud seeding, for example, during the Vietnam War to cause heavy rains to interfere with movements of troops on the ground and so on. So there's a lot of different aspects to this whole issue. I think one of the most concerning is, of course, that it's a very appealing political way out. The oil industry and other fossil fuel industries, polluting industries, would be just delighted to see that there was a trap, you know, backdoor, trap door that would allow them to escape from regulation and allow business as usual to continue.
Excuse me.
So that's another, you know, one of the big concerns.
You know, it's my friend Stephanie McMillan and I have been talking about geoengineering ever since we've been friends, probably, gosh, I don't know, 10 years now or something. And she was the one who first told me this, but I completely agree that really the sort of geoengineering has been the direction that the capitalists have wanted to go from the beginning. Basically just don't do anything until it's so dire and then say, okay, we have an emergency. And by the way, we can make money off of this emergency too. And it's not in terms of a conspiracy, but in terms of, I love my friend George Drafin's line about how you don't have to have a conspiracy when everybody thinks the same. That when you have this mindset that you can actually control the planet, actually, instead of going that direction, the direction I want to go is I want to key in on two words that you said during your wonderful introduction there. One of the words was chaotic and one of the words was unanticipated. And I guess the question I would have for anybody who supports geoengineering is if they can name any times that human supremacists in this culture have managed large-scale landscapes and have been able to anticipate all the results of their actions.
Yeah. Well, that's a very good question, and I think we know the answer is no. but we can also anticipate that there would be people out there who would say, yes, of course, we anticipated, you know, all of the possibilities, and we're in control. There's a huge, you know, different frame of mind out there that really does believe that technology can control nature, and that we are at the helm, if you will, and in control.
Well, let's talk about specifically, I guess there's sort of three directions I want to go. One of them is, so what can, you sort of alluded to it, but what can go wrong? Let's say that they do the sulfur particles, sulfate particles. Let's say they spew those out there. We don't have to have a disaster nightmare scenario, but let's talk about just some of the things that could go wrong with that.
Sure. I mean, what we already know just from doing modeling studies and also from looking at the effects of volcanic eruptions is that, you know, that yes, it does cause cooling in some places, and depending on how air moves and how the climate behaves and weather patterns and so on, it can actually cause cooling in one place and more heating in another place. And we know in particular that it affects rainfall. So after, you know, the previous volcanic eruptions of Pinatubo and others that we've seen, we know that they've caused, you know, severe droughts in other parts of the globe. So it's a very dynamic system, and people do not have control over it and do not understand it fully. But we do know from previous observation that there are unequal results. So, for example, it could be possible for us here in the U.S. to say, oh, we're going to spew sulfate particles over some you know, certain area of North America in order to cool and improve our outcomes in terms of agriculture output. But it will come at the cost of, say, and this is just hypothetical, but it will come at the cost of rainfall somewhere else, which could be, say, you know, in South America or somewhere else. So we know that that kind of thing happens just from looking at modeling studies and previous experience with volcanoes. The other thing we know is that sulfate particles in the stratosphere interact in different ways chemically, and we certainly do not know all about that, far from it. But we do know that it will cause further degradation of the ozone layer. So that's another, you know, huge concern for people who are watching this.
Let's talk for a moment about the nitrogen, the fertilizing with iron in the ocean, because I've read and I mean, I think you know my perspective on all this stuff, but the accounts I've read of the ocean fertilization are that, gosh, this is a win-win situation because it makes more phytoplankton, which ends up making more food for various fish. And it actually will, you know, in the case of the Pacific Northwest, help the salmon tremendously. And these are the accounts I've been reading. And once again, I am not, I am of the opinion that, that nature always knows best, and that when we meddle, it's the sorcerer's apprentice is the one that I always, the thing I always think about, that we meddle and we just mess things up. But can you tell me some of the, can you counteract that? Because the accounts I've read have been particularly glowing, and of course they've been written by boosters.
Yeah, well, one thing is that they have not found an, you know, a sequestering of carbon as a result of this. And I don't pretend to be any expert on ocean iron fertilization, but there was the case, recently in British Columbia where, this company, Planktos came in and essentially, you know, from what it appears, they presented this as a salmon restoration project for, the Native Americans that lived there, and then conducted a test with dumping iron into the water. This was not, did not go through any regulatory review or any permitting review or anything of that sort that I'm aware of. And, then it was found that this was being done. People were pretty upset because in fact there are international conventions in place that, are meant to prevent that kind of, you know, abuse, if you will. So there's a London Convention and there's, conventions on ocean dumping. And then there's, other international agreements that have been put in place to try and prevent that. So, this was kind of a rogue, operation that should not have been, should not have happened and is still being debated. And, the tests that have been done have not been very glowing. I'm not sure which ones you've seen, but the ones that I've seen do not show that there's been, you know, a huge plankton bloom. The plankton blooms happen, but the potential for carbon sequestration, so far as I know, has not worked out quite as planned.
So what is the and I guess another thing that I want to bring into this is do you know about Jevons paradox?
I think so. If you refresh me.
Yeah, Jevons paradox is this guy, this economist back in the 19th century, found that when the price of coal went down, or when there was some sort of when there was some sort of advancement in technology having to do with actually, instead of me doing this, I'm going to do a quick search, as long as we're using Skype anyway, because instead of me saying ridiculous things, I should just go ahead and say what it really is. The proposition that as technology progresses, the increase in efficiency with which a resource is used tends to increase rather than decrease the rate of consumption. So basically, there was a technological advancement associated with coal usage, and instead of that meaning that people would have to use less coal, it made it so it was cheaper, and so they used more coal. And this has been happening again and again and again. And the reason I bring this up is because it seems to me that even if we ignore the, you know, what could possibly go wrong with this scenarios here, all this would really do is it actually would not decrease global warming as such. What it would do is give them carte blanche to go ahead and spew more emissions.
Yeah, well, that is.
You see what I'm trying to get at?
Yes, I do. Absolutely. I mean, the Jevons paradox, I've heard that talked a lot about in terms of like people who buy a Toyota Prius then feel that because they're driving a lower, you know, a more efficient car, they actually drive more and it counters the savings that they could potentially get. So that's one that people can relate to. But no, absolutely. That's the concern is that by introducing, you know, a way out, if you will, this climate geoengineering will perpetuate the mindset that we can continue to spew. And in fact, the models basically used by the IPCC and so on that are promoting, say, bioenergy and carbon capture and sequestration, they just refer to it as like negative emissions. In other words, producing energy while actually reducing emissions, if you can imagine. But they actually incorporate into their models the idea of overshoot. So there's a budget of how much carbon we can afford to still put into the atmosphere, according to those who believe that they are knowledgeable enough to figure that out or that we're not already way past that point. But anyway, and that we can we can take our time a little bit more because we can allow a certain amount of overshoot to happen because policies and behavior hasn't changed fast enough. And we can then later on clean up that overshoot mess with these technologies. So it's essentially, you know, very much related to the Jevons paradox in some ways.
And another thing that this all makes me think of is that that just a couple of days ago, somebody was saying to me that they think that one reason this culture needs to be kept around is because nuclear power plants are so dangerous that we need to keep this society going to maintain the, just a sec, I need to hang up the phone. We need to maintain this culture so that we can keep the nuclear power plant safe, never mind the fact that this culture is destroying everything else. But there would be a similar thing, as my understanding, especially with the sulfate particles, is that once you commit yourself to that, then you have to maintain it, right? This is also committing ourselves, because once you stop doing it, then because you've continued to emit CO2 in the meantime, when you stop doing it, suddenly there's this massive jump. Even if everything goes right for them, we're still committing ourselves to that particular path, right?
Yeah, exactly. I always like to use the analogy of a drug addiction because, you know, particularly with the sulfate particle injection technology, because, yeah, it just treats the symptoms. It does not treat the underlying cause of global warming. And yes, it would allow, you know, continued ongoing flow of CO2 into the atmosphere, and you'd have to ramp up how much sulfate you were spewing into the stratosphere as more CO2 gets dumped in there. The other thing is that it does not at all address, because it doesn't address the underlying causes, it doesn't address the problem of ocean acidification, which is, of course, the other huge catastrophic impact of rising CO2 in the atmosphere. So the oceans would continue to get more acidic. And yeah, you can't just one day decide to quit unless you want to, you know, cause incredible, you know, damage because you're basically hooked into it. You would have a huge, very abrupt spike in warming if you were to quit.
So you mentioned the CIA, and do you know who some of the other major players are in promoting various geoengineering schemes? Are there notable players in it?
Well, and I wouldn't really say necessarily the CIA is a huge player. They are interested in the question and did contribute funding to it. But there's kind of a small clique of people, sometimes referred to as the geoengineering clique. And as you might imagine, they're all white men from the north. And, you know, like, for example, David Keith, they have funding from the Gates Foundation. They have some links with tar sands money, as I understand. You know, there are conservative think tanks that are interested in it. And interestingly, some of the groups that have been, and some of the individuals, I should say, rather, who have been involved in promoting it are formerly people who were very much involved in the whole denial of climate change and then have suddenly become very concerned about it, apparently.
Which was the point I was trying to make when I mentioned the thing about what I said about my friend Stephanie McMillan, is mm-hmm. that's sort of a classic – that's what we would precisely expect capitalists to do in their financial interest, is deny there's a problem, and then when it's time to – when they can no longer deny there's a problem, suddenly provide the solution to the problem, which also, not coincidentally, makes them money and does not actually affect the power structures or the – or business as usual.
Yeah. No, exactly. And that's a familiar pattern for us in many different dimensions by now. And it's true in the climate geoengineering as well.
And I wish I could find this. There's somewhere I wrote about, you mentioned that guy, David Keith, I believe his name is, or something.
Yeah.
And I wrote about him somewhere. I can't remember where. And there were some fantastic quotes from him, even as he's promoting geoengineering. And even, I believe this is about the thing with decreasing how much sunlight gets to the earth, that he was saying, well, if things go wrong, this could end life on earth.
Yeah. Yeah. They don't mince words sometimes. It's interesting.
Yeah. It's kind of like, my friend, once again, George Drafin, always used to say that he loved reading the Wall Street Journal because there the capitalists don't have to bother to lie. I mean, this is for capitalists by capitalists. And so they just go ahead and say, yeah, we're going to go ahead and, you know, colonize this place and take over this place. And they have no bones about it.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
So what, before we talk about what you would prefer to geoengineering, let's talk about, what do you think, and I recognize the crystal ball is always cloudy, but what do you think will happen? What do you foresee happening vis-a-vis geoengineering in the next 2, 5, and 10 years? And go ahead. I mean, this is not your happy scenario. This is your most probable political scenario.
Well, shall I allow the pessimist or the optimist to take the...
Do both. Give me both of them.
You know, the worst case scenario is that things rapidly degrade and, you know, agriculture collapses and people are hungry and civil unrest is, you know, happening everywhere. And, you know, the planet is in collapse and somebody says, well, you know, let's just try this. We don't really know whether it'll work or not, but things are so bad. It's a last resort. And we all know that under, you know, dire circumstances like that, that, you know, democracy and participatory decision making usually goes straight out the window. And because some of these things can be done, you know, unilaterally, somebody might decide to do it and, you know, essentially set off like a competition among nations to control the atmosphere. So there's a sort of worst case scenario. A better case scenario is that, some effective, form of governance and decision making might be put into place, but I'm not hugely optimistic about that. I mean, you know, fact is that we haven't been able to get any kind of an international consensus on what to do about the problem of climate change. So I'm not sure that I have a lot of faith in an international consensus on how to govern climate geoengineering. But, and there are some international agreements already in place, but as we've seen, they sometimes get ignored. Ocean iron fertilization most recently. So, you know, that's a problem. Right now, I think part of what the debate is happening in the very immediate is that, you know, these National Academy Science reports came out a few days before that, actually, timed apparently to coincide, was a commentary in Nature, written by, authored by a woman, Jane Long, who has been a prominent figure in the Solar Radiation Management Governance Initiative, which is a group, including environmental groups like Environmental Defense Fund and some others who are trying to sort of, from their perspective, get ahead of the game and figuring out how to get governance in place before this technology moves forward too fast. But in any case, their commentary in Nature basically was calling for more research on climate geoengineering. And the National Academy of Science reports basically said, you know, there is no, we should not be considering this straight off the bat. We should not be considering this as an alternative to reducing emissions. These are risky, unknown, many unknowns. We need to concentrate our attention on dealing with the root causes of the problem and addressing emissions, but we should be doing more research on these things. And in particular, because there's a lot of squeamishness around the solar radiation management and sulfate particle injection, there's a lot of squeamishness around that. But there's a lot more acceptance of the idea that, you know, growing trees and crops and plants and so on, it all sounds really good. And that some of these other, you know, biomass and plant-based, very large-scale tree plantations, which is another carbon dioxide removal technique, if you will. It's not really a technology, I suppose. Or bioenergy with carbon capture and sequestration, these kinds of things that are more benign. So there's a lot more support for those, I think, and a lot, they're less contentious. And they can be done on a smaller scale, and they're kind of already happening in many cases anyway. So the call is really to focus more on those, but also with the understanding that really the potential for those to really address global CO2 concentrations is pretty limited, that there's concerns, you know, at least concerns given lip service about the amount of plant biomass that we could burn or bury in the bottom of the ocean. So I guess we can be thankful that people are recognizing that it might not make sense to raise too much of the planet. But that's the dynamic right now. There's a lot more support for these, you know, carbon dioxide removal approaches than for the solar radiation management. The solar radiation management is worrying, though, because, as I said earlier, it's inexpensive to do, and it could be done unilaterally. There are a lot of unknowns. We know some things about it, and they're not very good, really. So, I don't know what to say about, you know, the 10-year scenario. You know, I worry that a lot of time and energy gets dumped into, and money gets dumped into researching these things, and that could be put to much better use. Also that it creates a certain momentum because, you know, academic institutions and so on get, caught up in the whole thing of getting grants and studying this. And once that happens, that careers are built on it and they have new initiatives in their departments and this and that and the other thing, you know, which we've seen happen in other domains. And then people want to perpetuate their livelihoods as, you know, career geoengineering researchers. So, those are all various different concerns around the just sort of the question of whether we should be researching this. Another concern is that some of the questions that we really most need to know the answers to, which include things like, you know, what would be the impacts, the differential impacts in different regions of the planet of doing something like solar radiation management. Those are questions we can't really answer with small scale studies. And so, as Naomi Klein, she has a great chapter on climate geoengineering in her book, In These Times, This Changes Everything. And she also commented on the Nature commentary that I mentioned, and she points that out again there, that the real key questions that we need answers to can only be addressed by full-scale deployment. This is a global atmosphere. It's a global, the questions are about how the impacts are distributed around the globe, and we can't find that out by little small-scale studies. We can find out things about whether sulfate particles are better delivered to the stratosphere via a hose or via an airplane, or what kind of nozzle should be on the hose. But why bother doing that until we have answers to some of the other questions about how this is going to affect people in different parts of the world?
I keep thinking about, this probably won't surprise you, but it may surprise some people, that the truth is that I'm actually very conservative. And the reason I say that is because I just think it's a terribly bad idea to foreclose future possibilities by, for example, wiping out passenger pigeons or salmon or whatever. And one of my favorite lines I've ever read was written or said by someone, I believe one of the victims, who did not die, obviously, of the Bhopal catastrophe. And one of the people said, no one should be allowed to make poisons for which there is no antidote. And it just strikes me as a tremendously bad idea to conduct open-air experiments, whether those open-air experiments are bathing the world in endocrine disruptors or neurotoxins or carbon dioxide or sulfate particles. It just seems like doing once you – okay, I live right next to a little pond, and when I first moved here, somebody suggested that I put in some goldfish just to have nice little goldfish in the pond. And I didn't, because it's a lot easier to never take – it's a lot easier to not put goldfish in than it is to take them out when they mess up the local habitat for the frogs. And it just seems with all this stuff, I keep thinking of the first rule of medicine, you know, do no harm. Or we could talk about this in terms of the precautionary principle. Anyway, sorry, I'm just rambling. Go ahead.
No, I think those are all very relevant points. And the precautionary principle is, you know, it's a beautiful thing, at least in theory. And practice it often gets overlooked, unfortunately. But yeah, I mean, I totally agree. I think, you know, for example, you know, endocrine disruptors, people didn't consider that that was an experiment. It was just as people don't consider an oil train blowing up in their backyard to be an experiment. It's just something that somebody decided was a good idea and they went out and did it, you know? So, and people didn't really have a say in how that was going to play out and what the consequences were going to be. So, I know nobody ever asked me if I thought endocrine disruptors in my, you know, plastic kids' toys were okay. So there's a little bit of a difference in the way things are presented, whether they're presented as an experiment, you know, and a grant and government funding and we're doing research, as opposed to a commercial venture, you know.
Well, I think, for what it's worth, I think that the way geoengineering is going to go, my guess, is the same way that nanotechnology and drones, or, you know, basically almost any technology goes, which is we have discussions where some people say, oh, this is a terrible idea, and other people say this is the best idea in the world, and then we have some discussions about whether it should be regulated, some discussions about how it should be regulated, and then the next thing you know, basically there are a handful of us who are just begging for there to be at least labeling when it does happen. My point is that there seems to be this sort of momentum, or seems to be a pattern that I've seen with a lot of these technologies, where there is a robust discussion happens for a little while, and then all of a sudden, this happened with nanotechnology. It's like we're having this discussion about whether it should happen in the real world, and then the next thing you know, they're making pants with nanotechnology in the pants. And it's like, when did this transition occur? I don't remember the place where it moved from theoretical experiments to a standard part of my life.
Yeah, that's because we don't have any mechanisms really in place for doing really valid and, real technology assessments where people get to make those decisions. It's too often just driven by commercial interests or other forces. So it's, I totally agree. And synthetic biology is one that we're watching right now, like nanotechnology, you know, where the commercial uses and releases of synthetic biology products and so on is is galloping along while the discussions in the background about whether or how it should be regulated, or whether it should even be done, are trailing along a million miles along, you know, behind. So it's kind of almost like it's a done deal. And why are we sitting here talking about regulating it? It's a, you know, bad attitude. We got to do what we can do. But the thing I think is that we need to recognize that just because we can develop some technology does not mean that we should. And we need to have policies in place, at some level or other. I mean, we need the awareness of that issue, but we also need some policies in place that will really put, you know, participatory democratic decision making behind these technologies before they have galloped along a million miles into commercial release. I mean, another one is just, you know, in the last few days, I work with the campaign to stop GE trees, and we've been following, you know, developments of field testing and the USDA regulatory processes and so on and so forth, especially around GE eucalyptus, which was moving quickly. And then a few days ago, suddenly discovered that a GE loblolly pine was permitted by the USD without any regulation whatsoever, because the way the gene was inserted, the USDA thought didn't require them to regulate it the same way they would if it was potentially a plant pest. So it fell through this loophole, and they just allowed it right through, and now we have a GE tree that's been right through the regulatory process while we were there, you know, trying hard in the background to ensure that GE trees were very rigorously regulated and hopefully never commercially released. So these things happen all the time in technology development, and we need different ways of relating to technology.
Right. I completely agree. And we have about 3 or 4 minutes left. And before I ask you a couple wind-up questions, I want to surprise you by saying that I'm going to come out in public right now as a huge fan of specific, very particular types of geoengineering. And you want to hear what they are?
Sure.
This did not surprise me at all. I just read an article a couple days ago. The headline is, "Wetland swamps, quote, hold great potential, end quote, to store carbon, fight climate change." And wetlands can store approximately 50 times as much carbon as quite high carbon sequestration ecosystems such as tropical rainforests, said one of the academics. So here is my geoengineering proposal, is I would strongly support restoring forests, prairies, and wetlands because they can all sequester such great carbon. And, well, also for other reasons too, that they would – and not to store it and then cut it down and bury it, but instead let the plants actually, like the grasses could bury it in their roots, and the swamps could bury it in the mud, and the trees could hold it in the trees. What do you think of that geoengineering idea?
Yeah, no, I know. That's exactly how I think about it all the time. I'm like, why are we not having serious discussions, and why are we not dumping this research and development funding and everything else into halting deforestation, for example, or restoring, you know, depleted soils or any of the other obvious things? And it's very frustrating that they're not technologies. You know, people are fascinated by technology, and nature just doing its thing is just not as, you know, not as fascinating. There's not money to be made in the same way, and there's not control to be had in the same way. I think those are big factors. And there's also, for example, with bioenergy, carbon capture and sequestration, part of the whole issue of bioenergy is that we can make energy. So, you know, we would argue that you could do a better job of sequestering carbon by allowing a forest to grow than you could by burning the trees and offsetting some fossil fuels, maybe. But the point is, you don't get energy that way. You get a forest. And people want energy, not forests, in many cases. So I mean, of course, I'm totally with you. That's obviously, there's huge potential in just, you know, if we just stopped destroying the planet and allowed it to heal, we would have made a huge lot of progress, and there would be all kinds of other associated benefits, you know, water and food and everything else, biodiversity.
So if you were, the rule here is you can't bring down capitalism or civilization within the next 2 months or something, but you are put in charge of all processes associated with combating global warming. What would you do? You're the queen of stopping global warming. And what would you do? what would be your immediate policy? The reason I say you can't bring down capitalism or civilization is because I want to know sort of immediate policy changes with the understanding that wild nature has to take over in the middle term. But what would you do immediately? What would you do tomorrow? What would you want to have happen?
Oh boy. Well, you know, I mean, of course, I think it's absolutely right that we need to cease burning fossil fuels. There are two things. We need to cease burning fossil fuels, and we need to not pretend that we can continue destroying ecosystems. And that is often a tension because people want to stop using fossil fuels and instead use biofuels. So to me, that's kind of the key thing is say, okay, we do need to stop using fossil fuels, and we also need to recognize that there just isn't an alternative form of energy. And that unto itself is likely to bring down civilization. But
right.
Those are the things that we actually need to do. And I think it's really, you know, key that we have voices willing to just say these things, because it's not very common. You see even, you know, groups, Greenpeace and so on, you know, let's just switch to 100% renewable energy, as if there is some form of energy out there that is just going to satisfy all these demands. And we can just sort of plug it in and keep on business as usual, just using a different form of energy. And that's just simply not the case. We need to realize that the whole way we live and relate to our use of energy has got to dramatically shift. And people need to be saying that and understanding that, and understanding that we need to work and live in harmony with the forces of nature and with nature and with, you know, biodiversity, and not imagine that we can somehow have control over it and have it all bend to our will and satisfy our every desire. So, you know, that's sort of in a nutshell, I guess. It's, you know, system change, not climate change, is the call that climate justice activists always say, and question, what do you really mean by that? Well, a lot of different things. I think, you know, the thing is that the entire system, we're all bound up in it. You know, racism is part of the solution. Ending racism is part of the solution. Providing, you know, tackling the issue of, you know, the inequity of distribution of wealth, making sure that people have health care and their basic needs met. All of these things are all part of the system that needs to, you know, be changed. And we can't do it just as quote unquote climate activists, because the issue of climate is too abstract and too sort of meaningless, because it's rooted in all these different issues. So I think the thing for us is to try and bring people together who are working in different silos of activism to recognize that we have a common vision and a common goal, and that our interests are common, and try to move forward as a more united front. The oil companies have, you know, an incredible stranglehold on everything. You know, they believe, you know, in complete disregard for all of what we know about climate change. They will say, as they did, just the Shell exec said just a couple of days ago, you know, there will be a market for our oil. So we're not concerned about, you know, divestment and regulation and all of that. There will be a market for the only way to address the problem of climate change is if you figure out some way to make our oil emissions free. So they just take it as a, you know, take it as an assumption that all the oil reserves that are known about will be accessed and sold on the market somewhere. And, you know, they may be right. So we're really up against something quite monumental. But I believe, you know, as you, I think, would say that, you know, the more we can understand and live in harmony with nature, as people have been saying for decades, the better off we will be in the long run.
Well, I want to really thank you for that whole last little speech you gave in response to my last question. I think that's just so fantastic, and not enough people are saying it. And thank you so much. And we're out of time, and thank you for being on the program. Thank you very much for listening. My guest today has been Rachel Smolker. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.